This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I don't know how many other Jefferson lecturers put on their Revolutionary War hat, but I will deliver part of the lecture with my hat on. So I'm going to talk about three things, and they will get increasingly speculative as we move along. So I'll give you some facts about the inequality and globalization and the ways I think they challenge our democracy. And then the most speculative part will be how we're going to meet these challenges or how we can meet them. And there is Hamilton, actually, on the $10 bill. And I thought about putting Jefferson, he's on the $2 bill, and he's also on the nickel. And this is basically the theme I want to go through. The threat we see from inequality is that wealthy people can use money to protect their money. And that was a deep concern of Mr. Jefferson, indeed. And then globalization, the concern is it doesn't matter what the state does. The state can't tax as much because capital is very mobile, so it can't redistribute income from the upper income groups to the lower income groups. And those are the two principal specters, that inequality weakens the democracy, and then even when the government might want to do something, the globalization says, no, you can't. And then the word feudalistic is more of a word used in Jefferson's time. But we think about multinationals and super wealthy folks making decisions. And then I had to add in to this, quote, the potential villains in this piece are people like many of the academics and people at Berkeley and myself. It's people who go around the globe and are not particularly tied to the country in which they live. Academics are prone to this, and so are a lot of multinational firms. And I know my university does not consider itself an American university. We are a global university, just the way IBM does not consider itself an American firm. And the question is how this can also weaken the things. So these are some things just to show you the historic and the Jefferson, and you have Hamilton. And the word aristocracy is not a word we use particularly nowadays to refer to things, but Jefferson's concern, the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. And de Tocqueville was also worried that we would create this permanent inequality and aristocracy. Interestingly, Jefferson was for free trade. So on the globalization debate, he would have been for globalization. But that was because the fear was that the tariffs and other protections from trade were going to strengthen the moneyed corporations. The farmers were not moneyed corporations. They were just individuals working. And Hamilton also, and that reflects the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution, which I'll say more about, because I immediately saw that as very interesting at a Jefferson lecture. It was not just more aristocratic things, it was more expert decisions. And we now have that in large part. The Federal Reserve will make some decisions today and tomorrow, unelected set of people, experts. I personally have great faith that Ben Bernanke will do good things, and we'll try to make the best decisions. But nonetheless, it's very interesting that a lot of how the economy will operate over the next, at least short-term period, will depend upon experts. You could call them aristocratic, but folks who were certainly not elected by anybody in our country. And then John Jay, who was part of the Hamilton gang or group, people who own the country ought to govern it. That is not very helpful to democracy. So we'll now see the double specters. So this, I'll go very quickly over the inequality. because I think there's just widespread agreement, and there could be no arguments about this. I started off with all the good things the U.S. economy has done, and we've been very successful in many ways. And we had excellent growth of GDP per capita over the last 16 years here. And then the skeleton is our distribution of income. We have got an extraordinary unequal distribution. So I'm going to give you some figures here just so you see the nature of it. The figure to the left that's a 90-10 ratio. It's at the bottom, and the top is a Gini coefficient. 90-10 ratio takes the wages of the people in the 90th percentile, divides it by the wages of people in the 10th percentile. It's a measure of labor market. Gini coefficient is for the overall income distribution. The dots are different countries, advanced countries. So Japan, Canada, Britain, Germany. And we're out there, obviously, number one in both of those metrics. The straight lines, the bar graphs to the right, are, to me, the most remarkable indication of how unequal our country is. The first one is a standard deviation of log earnings, which is a measure of earnings inequality. So higher numbers are more unequal. So it's a 0.88. That's all Americans. Then you go and you take Americans who have the same score on a global literacy test, which was done by the OECD, which was done in a number of advanced countries. And so those are people with similar abilities, at least measured by a literacy score. And you can narrow that further. You can do it by similar ability, exactly same gender, pretty much the same age. You can even look within broad occupations. And you basically will get similar results to this. Anybody, labor economists who work with earnings distributions, you know that you put in all the controls you want, and you're left with a lot of variability. And I like thinking about that as you have students in exactly the same class, all scoring reasonably well on an exam, and look at them 10 years later, you will see getting the same degree in the same university. I'm thinking of my own students taking a class in economics at Harvard. And when they graduate and go 10 years later, you'll have the investment banker making huge sums. You'll have the graduate student not making huge sums, as we know. And you'll have a just incredible dispersion. Then, because this data set, we were able to get figures for Germany, all workers, Netherlands, and Sweden. And the stunning thing is the inequality in the U.S. of people with the same scores, and I say you could break that down more, exceeds the inequality in earnings in those three European countries of everybody. That's people who can't read and people who can read, people in good jobs and people in bad jobs. And it's just indication, we're really far out in this inequality. Then I have some figures from the CIA World Factbook. There are other figures I could have chosen, but I chose that one because I thought some of my conservative friends might be very critical. And I would say, it's from the CIA, guys, so what do you expect? So there is the Gini coefficients. Higher Gini coefficient is more inequality. So India was lower than I would have expected, and maybe the figures are not so accurate. 0.33. China is 0.44. The U.S. is 0.45. U.S. and China have basically the same inequality of income. In the 118 countries for which the World Factbook gave data, the U.S. was 84th. That's 84th is meaning very low in equality. We're very unequal. Yeah, and the bottom half of developing countries. I was stunned at that as well, but this is all just this is a, we have a serious inequality, a problem, or issue or facts at least. We've also seen over the last 30 years, and 30 years meaning it's been through Republican administrations, it's been through Democratic administrations. It's not a partisan kind of fact. The facts aren't partisan in any case, And the blue line with the dots is the growth of is the level of real hourly earnings from the series that's the longest, the most extensive that we had. The top line with the little triangles, that's productivity growth. Productivity growth, and it's all centered around 1970 was the year I picked for just locking it as 100, and then it just grows. You see it just spanning out, and you see the productivity growth has been very good, and real wage growth has not. The intermediate lines are different measures of different real wage series. So there's a number of different series that one can look at. Some include non-wage compensation, such as pensions and health care, et cetera. But whichever one you pick, it's clearly that productivity growth has been very good, and none of the real wages of American workers have gone up that much. So we've had a rising, this obviously produces rising inequality. Well, productivity growth has helped some people, and hopefully these gentlemen will contribute money to our university, our universities, and we'll have a naming ceremony for this room or something. And I don't know how much they would change this from the Jefferson lecture to the Big Bucks lecture if Mr. Big Bucks would give the money. But it's clear these people have done extremely well, these very wealthy people. So I want to give you some extreme views of the American income distribution. And the perfect payday, CIOs reap millions by landing stock options when they are most valuable. Luck or something else? Great CEO pay heist, and you can read them. And then the one that I was stunned at when I saw in late September 2001, right after the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks, I didn't realize scores of companies ladled out options to executives worth millions. So they immediately said, the stock market falls. We know it's going to bounce back because right now people are in a panic. So what do? The first thing we do is we give options to ourselves dated now that the stock market is way down. So this particular gentleman calls us sleazeballs and profiteering ghouls. Is that what business is about? And then the last one is another. These are very radical statements. I would regard these as incredibly extreme statements. Where are they from? So you might have been guessing. You know, Jones. It's the Wall Street Journal, Fortune Magazine, the story that had not really, as far as I know, gotten very much attention was these executives writing the options for themselves right after the attack. It was the editor of the Harvard Business Review. And this was on a PBS broadcast. And then Forbes magazine. So this is reading of part of what's happened in the inequality in the country from... You can't get more conservative than these four organizations, you know, and conservative and honest and reputable and so on. You know, Forbes, Fortune, Wall Street Journal, exclusive of the editorial page is pretty accurate place. And the Harvard Business Review is pretty accurate. So that's sort of striking. As I say, I don't think there can be any argument about what's happened to the income distribution in the country and that something is awry with this. And then there's another radical commentary, and this is from Warren Buffett. You may have noticed he's been making a number of comments since he's given away his $40 billion or so to the Bill Gates Foundation, or $30 billion. And this was a statement, though, he made to his shareholders, in which the best line in this is the one right towards the end. If class warfare is being waged in America, my class is clearly winning. And then he goes on and points out that he paid a lower tax than his receptionist. And of course, what's going on there is it's Social Security, which is top coded, so you stopped at the top, and she's paying that, and he's not on the margin. So his marginal tax rate is actually lower than hers, and he's quite upset about this. So I think if we got all these, the Wall Street Journal and the Forbes and the Harvard Business Review And we have one of the country's second, he was till he gave away all his money, a lot of his money, the country's second wealthiest person. You don't have to be very radical to say this is a problem. Okay, so that's my first fact. And then what I want to do is in the lecture is go, we take that as given. If you want more evidence, there's multiple people, including many economists at Berkeley, have studied, we can just give you that kind of evidence. And then we'll want to know and say, well, what does that mean for our democracy? It's happened. It's here. We have a very unequal society. Now, the globalization. And so these are made-up quotes. I didn't search the web to find business people saying this, but certainly they say this all the time. And you could find this very easily. And I said the devil made me do it, but what we say is that it's the market made me do it, globalization made me do it, and the reason is that we've got cheap labor over there, and we can move. And how could I stay in business if my competitor moves to hire the cheaper labor? And that's a big and giant issue, a threat. The globalization, I want to give a couple of facts about the globalization so we understand, where that is. What we have had in the 1990s and the 2000s, and basically post the whole NAFTA discussion and debate, is a huge increase. I called it great doubling because the global workforce basically doubled in size when China, India, and the ex-Soviet joined us. When China and it was behind the Iron Curtain, the ex-Soviet were behind the Iron Curtain, and India sort of had made its own curtain around itself. It didn't really deal in the global world. That meant that basically 1.5 billion workers were out of the global capital system. And so, and there were about 1.5 billion in the global capital system. And so the doubling is just about right. What happens, any economist will tell you, if you increase the labor force by twice as much and don't increase the capital stock by that much, you are going to have a shift in market power towards capital. And I just phrased it here as it's more difficult for market forces to help workers. I'm thinking now of workers in the already advanced or the capital world, in our world. Obviously, this is extraordinarily good for the Chinese and the Indians, and it would be great for the ex-Soviets if they, even they get their act together reasonably. And they've had more troubles, I think. But the countries that have joined the EU certainly are going to be doing very, very well. In Poland, for instance, which is one of the larger ones, is doing very, very well. So we have this globalization, which suddenly, it's not just globalization, it's globalization with people who have much lower capital labor ratios than we have. And we have global capital flows, so it just moves overseas. And then I think it's more important what's going on in our sector, actually, or as important, is many of these countries, and particularly China, but India as well, and Brazil, and you just go down the country list, you see this. They made large investments in university education. So we see many graduate students from foreign countries here. A big reason for that is that there are many, many more undergraduates in foreign countries than there were 20 years ago. So if we thought that bringing these countries into the same global capitalist world was going to mean that they did all those guys do all the low-level work. They make the shoes, and we do all the educated work, which was the promise, you may remember, of the NAFTA debate. NAFTA was, we got to get all the educated stuff. We're going to shift over the bad jobs to the Mexicans, indeed. Well, nobody bothered to ask the Mexicans, who also increased their education system a lot, the Indians or the Chinese, who are sitting there saying, higher education seems to be really important in modern economic life. Here are these multinationals. You can get a job with IBM, with Cisco, whatever it is, get your skills. So they've made a huge investment in higher education. And the multinationals are spreading modern technology. If you go back to the 50s and 60s, the vision of globalization would have been, we have a monopoly of modern technology. Those other guys are using old stuff, and our workers, therefore, have a big edge. We have a big edge in capital, and we have a big edge in technology. And that both are going away. And so we see the results. A lot of trade, offshoring, immigration, tech transfers, not of the kind that they promised us during the NAFTA debate. That's just fact, I think. And people are worrying about this. Now, I put unless we screw up, I tend to be very favorable to the globalization. I think we got about 40, 50 years, and which these countries have got to come up quickly and grow rapidly, and their wages go up. And it's a transition to where they are going to be comparable to us in their education, in their use of technology, and so on. And I think everybody, you know, for the sake of the sort of the vast bulk of the humanity, everybody should have access to modern technology. Everybody should have capitalist market economies, because that's what works and the other things don't work. And they should all have advanced education. But if they're all going to get that, it's going to be they're starting from very low wages in these places. It's going to be an interesting and difficult transition. I think it's a transition process. And I say through trade and all these things. What has happened, interestingly, is global economic inequality has declined. It's declined fairly substantially since 1990. Since these countries have joined the modern world, if I can phrase it that way. Basically, it's because China and India have had such rapid growth rates, 9-10%, for China and India, 6-7%, that the very poorest people in the world, and the people in China and India had lower incomes per head than the people in Africa, on average, and then the Latin Americans, certainly. So they moved up, the very bottom moved up. At the same time, within every country, or I exaggerate, within most countries, says the chart, and that chart's more accurate than I am, inequality's gone up. And I want to point out that's not strictly globalization. That's not the only cause. Lots of things going on. I mentioned tech change and unionization. It's gotten weaker. But during the period of globalization, within country inequality has risen. It rose in the U.S. It's risen in China. It's just been rising over the last 5-6 years very sharply in Germany. It had risen in England earlier. It's just across the world we see that, which is an interesting phenomenon. You start thinking about the political aspect of this. The world is getting less unequal because the poorest people are coming up. But within every country, including those countries, inequality is getting bigger. And that creates, interesting issues. Now I want to point out, there's one thing that didn't come out on this slide. The telephone call there, or whatever that is, it's a change. It means change, different. On my computer, it came out as a little Greek delta. The U.S., that's just the U.S. We could pick Australia, Canada, Britain, all the advanced countries, but we try to focus on the U.S. We grew greatly during this period. So between 1990 and 2006, I show you our GDP per capita in purchasing power years was 1.9%. China grew at 8.9%. So you say, oh my God, China's really doing better. But then I show you the absolute dollar amount of what that growth amounted to. And we actually had basically twice as rapid a growth in real GDP per capita as China. And the reason, of course, for that is that China had such a low level of income at the beginning that even though they're growing much more rapidly than us, that actually added less real income, you know, to China. So we had a lot of income that we could distribute. Had we distributed the GDP per capita over this period evenly, everybody's income got up a percentage thing, or if we had done it evenly, just in lump sums to people, we could have given every family $11,300. That's what we did. And the question was, how did we distribute it? We've already seen we did not distribute it remotely evenly among families or among individuals. this per capita individual. And then I just said we've remained a mecca for immigrants, skilled and unskilled. So my view is that globalization is certainly not harming the U.S. economy writ broadly. It is probably contributing somewhat to the rise of inequality. And therefore, it's something that we can deal with if we deal with our own problems. I wouldn't want to be blaming the Chinese or the Indians. There's Tom Jefferson again. And I don't know, some of you people may remember the guy over there. And you might say what that is a current American student. If you've read a lot of the reports about American students not doing well and dot, 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 dot. Turns out the most recent look at that says that American students, they're not reading Mad magazines in their high schools. They may not be as intellectual as Tom Jefferson, but they're doing fine. At the same point that we've had this globalization, labor standards around the world have gone up. You've all heard about race to the bottom, so the globalization is... One of my themes is going to be globalization is not the cause of problems. The cause of problems is something internal to us and therefore internal to our politics. It's how we're dealing with something that has not affected our GDP growth has been excellent. It's just who it goes to. You say, well, there's going to be these race to the bottoms. It turns out, no, there isn't. We've got now very good evidence from a set of experiments by one of my colleagues in the government department, Michael Hiscox, who's been auctioning off coffee on the web, and then he's auctioning off T-shirts on eBay, and he finds definitely people are willing to pay more money if you can guarantee something is made under good conditions. So he has things made under good conditions, and then he removes the labels on some of it and sells it without that label, and you see it's worth about 20-25% more people are willing to pay for this. They're making such good money doing this that I think his graduate student may be leaving the university to sell good products on the web, set up an internet store. Similarly, I give an example of Nike. When they were targeted by activists, and they were very, very rough, nasty company in many ways, they've done a complete about-face, so now they're very good. And China's introduced a new labor law. The only country I know that has reduced its labor standards during this period of time is Australia. And on November, I think it's 24th or 26th, if there's some Australians here, you know the date, John Howard will be out of office precisely because he introduced a labor law that reduced the standards of Australian workers. And it's the only time I know where a labor law thing is turning over a prime minister, and he's just lost the whatever it is that the Australians felt faith in him. So this globalization does not, driving us down and so on. And we have these two facts, rising inequality, and we have globalization. And the globalization, our incomes have gone up. It's just gone to some people, not others. Labor standards, not only in the U.S., but around the world, have not been driven down by this. Indeed, they're going up in lots of countries. And now what is the question for the democracy? And that really is the Jeffersonian question for this. And I put the challenge, it's to democracy and to what I think of as how well we manage this 40 to 50 year transition. And 40 to 50 years, you might say, well, that's a number out of your hat. I'll change hats for the moment on that. But no, it isn't. It's based, one, upon very simple modeling of an analysis of how quickly Chinese growth is and at what point they will reach a level relative to ours if they keep growing very rapidly in India. And then it is based upon how long it took Japan and Korea to get up to the level. Korea was, the poorest country in the world after the Korean War. They had no resources, and they just hard work and education, really, is what made Korea, and some U.S. help. But Korea did a lot of things on their own. And so the best you could hope for in a country that started very poor is 40 to 50 years, they can get up to the first rank of places. So this is the challenge to democracy. And I'm going to give you some evidence on all of these. If you're non-wealthy, it turns out people who are non-wealthy vote less. You've got chance, you have less chance getting elected, less chance of having influence, and that means something. I gave a talk recently, and some more radicalish person than I jumped on me for having said that U.S. GDP growth was very good, which it has been. And they said, well, what difference does that make? Most people haven't had real income increases or have had very small real income increases. And then that is the point here. Yeah, growth of GDP, which economists like the privileges, that's what we should see, good growth of GDP. That's what we always look for and put in the papers. It can be very different than growth of citizen well-being. And that's partly the story of the U.S. over the last, I think, 30 years. Then I said they're reducing the scope for government to operate. And if we go through this transition period of adjusting to China and India catching up with us in education, catching up with us in technology, catching up with us in lots of stuff, it can be a very difficult transition without, I think, democratic oversight. And I call this fair distribution of benefits and costs, which is important. I'll talk about the inequality in politics. In voting, we've had a generally turnout has dropped over time. It came up a little bit in the last election, and hopefully it'll be higher in the next election. But in fact, there was a large drop in turnout over the period 64 to 2000, and the drop was really big among less educated people and lower paid people. So today we have a more more inequality in voting has increased. Now here you might say, well, that's just, it's their choice. And in one sense, the less educated decided not to vote, and the lower paid decided not to vote. And what can we do about that? Well, there are things we could do about it, and there are things many of the states are trying to do things. I think it's been a fair effort by many of our states. But right now, the voting has shifted from what it was in the 1960s, so more and more disproportionately number of the voters tend to be higher educated, which some of us here might like, and so on. Then I just got some counts of how many millionaires there were in the Senate and the House. There were two different counts, so I don't know if the Senate's 44 or 50. There's the House, and then I put in things, but that's been worse in U.S. history. We have a history of our leaders being way wealthier than the average citizen. Abe Lincoln was very strange in that sense. And then we've had some political campaigns, both by Democrats and Republicans, and by Mr. Bloomberg, who's now an independent, where Mr. Corzine, the governor, and who was senator, now governor of New Jersey, he basically bought the state of New Jersey election. You know, and he's a Goldman Sachs ex-executive, and he decided he wanted to become senator. So he spent whatever, $60 million, $80 million, $100 million, whatever it was, and anybody wants to run against him, he's got a real problem. Mr. Cole is the senator from Wisconsin, and he says to the voters, don't worry, I'm so rich, I'm not taking any money, so I'm going to do whatever I want for you people. And that's fine. And Mr. Bloomberg, we know, spent huge sums of money, and there was at one point earlier this year, you know, some discussion he could run for president because he could just write a check for $1 or $2 billion. And if you have $1 or $2 billion campaign, you'd outspend both political parties. And that's a big thing. And one of the interesting things is when people spend, politics spend a lot of time seeking funds, and we look at the contributions, it's clear a lot of rich people and a lot of companies regard that as a really good investment. So there's an economics question. How come they're not spending more money on these elections? Because, in fact, the return you get from being close to the White House when the government starts giving away, sort of contracts and so on, that's really pays off. So I say economics are things. How come the politicians aren't charging more money or the campaigns aren't more expensive than they would be? Well, this is American history. It's not quite Jefferson's time, but what the heck, it's old enough to show. And this is, you may not be able to read it. It says, none but millionaires need apply. And it's called the coming style of presidential election. And so all the rich millionaires are saying, I want to run for president. And of course, if you do want to run for president and you do not have 100 million or 500 million or something, gee, you ought to think twice. You better find someone with that kind of money, because it is clear that this has become a very much of a rich person's game. Now, since the Halloween, I give you the monster over there. This is how many lobbyists we have. K Street, 35,000 registered lobbyists, etc. And then the way to understand how interlinked this is with our politics, 43% of the guys who left Congress, since 1998, so that's pretty recently, and so probably this is 2005, 2006 number, they became lobbyists. So what you do is you get into Congress, you're likely to be a millionaire, or you're certainly dependent on rich folks, and then when you leave, you become a lobbyist. And so you start thinking, well, that's the way we think democracy should be operating with these kind of characters. Now, I've got no strong evidence that, of course, they're doing crooked or bad things. But I think we've heard of some of these guys in K Street, and we know some of them have been caught, and et cetera. There's the list of how many of the former members or heads of agencies were lost. American people believe lobbyists have too much power. Believe it's common to them to bribe members of Congress. I don't think that's that frequent, because I think there's been like one California guy and somebody from Ohio been caught on real bribe kinds of stuff. But it's much more. You get all huge contributions to your political campaign that are presumably legal, but that clearly affects what you do. And people can worried about corruption in Washington. So money has clearly played a substantial role in this. We then have our own world. And I don't know how much Berkeley or whether the citizens of California, whether you could change your name if some billionaire offered you enough money. I list here a bunch of foundations that were formed. Basically reflect very favorable to wealthy folks. They're right-wing foundations. I've taken money from Smith Richardson Foundation. I have worked for the Heritage and the AEI. So I don't want to, that may be good or bad about these foundations. The Asherman Professorship, which is what I hold, was originally, the title of the professorship was for the preservation of capitalism and defeat of European social welfare states. And we had to explain to the man giving the money that really the university, this was not the appropriate title for a professorship. And I tried to explain to the man giving the money that the one thing he should absolutely never allow to do, the university, to give this professorship to an existing professor. Because what he wanted was somebody to do empirical work from a fairly conservative perspective. And I say, if they give it to somebody on the professorship, we'll just go off and hire some mathematical economist and we'll just, you know, shift the resources. So you can never let them give it. I left for a year, and in that period of time, the university dean got to him. And lo and behold, I was called up and said, oh, you're the professor. And I said, but I'm not what this guy really wants. He says, don't worry, we fooled him. And now we can appoint some mathematical economist who, you know, with what previously been the money that went for my chair. But the point is, this has been a big movement, so that when you have wealth, it doesn't simply buys politicians, and buys it in the bribery sense. It also affects universities, and it affects think tanks, and it affects professorships, because they give you lots of money. So money tends to do that. Now we bring the Hamilton Project, in which I worked on, and I've got a paper, and I may have a second paper coming along in the Hamilton Project. I found in checking Jefferson and Hamilton on the internet, this popped up, and there's poor Tom's grave, and supposedly he's turning over in his grave on this Hamilton Project, so I apologized to him. And what the Hamilton Project is is, quote, according to this particular critic, a thinly veiled pursuit of moving party policy making from the grassroots of voter primaries and caucuses to the golden financial roots of Manhattan. Meaning the Hamilton Project is funded by Wall Street money, which I believe it is, and it is an effort of basically conservative democratic groups to influence politics and political outcomes in the directions that they would like. And I think it is correct that naming it after Hamilton, I said, geez, he a great icon of the Democratic Party. The history is, of course, he was the opposition to the Democratic Party. He was the Federalist Party. And this particular gentleman, who is a very distinguished analyst of U.S. politics, Kevin Phillips, just thought this was awful. So I apologize to Tom Jefferson for the paper that was referred to. But be clear, it was a paper for redistribution of income to graduate students and not towards the money elite. And I took a lot of flack from the Hamilton Project people as to why we just shouldn't hire immigrants to do the science engineering. Why should Americans be doing this work? And I thought maybe in the back of their heads is they want all the bright Americans to, again, work for Wall Street firms. They don't want any competition offered to them. I don't know. So that's this thing. And then I just think of the level of the way in which money can incredibly affect politics. I had this nightmare. I suppose I should have put some cartoon, Halloween things there. Bill Gates. He's done wonderful. I think the Gates Foundation is just wonderful. They're spending money probably faster than they should, but they have to under the tax laws. They're doing great things. But just imagine if he had a different view. If he took $40 billion to fund policy research focused on preserving wealth. He could have. There's no question he could have done that. Buy control of the media. He could have said, Rupert Murdoch, you're a left-wing creep. I'm going to buy CBS and NBC, and I'm going to really show people what they should think. He could have set up a university that would destroy Harvard and Berkeley, Gates University. He would have offered every professor $500,000, and we'd all be gone out the door. And he, et cetera. And this could have incredibly affected. So the level of power that exists with the money is just, to me, remarkable intellectual debate and policy. Thank goodness he has not done that. And he has done, his foundation does not do that. But that's certainly a danger would exist. And so who knows what the next multi-billionaire will decide to do with their money. I should just make one comment about the American multi-billionaires. When I was in Argentina is doing very badly, and I said, where is the Ross Perot of Argentina? Where is the businessman who thinks he can save the country? And in Argentina, they looked at me and they said, in Argentina, you don't use money to get politics as you do in the U.S. In Argentina, you get into politics to make money. And that's a different thing. And then I give a statement which shocked me, because I was telling one of my friends, I'm giving this talk here, and I said, what do you think about dot, dot, dot? And he first said, oh, you've got to quote Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And I said, does Jefferson know very much about Rousseau? And he said, well, Jefferson, he can read French. And it turns out Jefferson did not think all that much of Rousseau. But nonetheless, this is a statement about, you know, how money gets in. And then the stunning thing is they pay mercenary troops. And then at the bottom, this friend of mine said, do you know there's more private contractors in Iraq than U.S. military personnel? And I said, that can't possibly be true. And so he sent me the site. I give the site to you, and there you give the numbers. The contractors, by the way, were all being paid out of taxpayers' money. These are the Blackstone guys and the independents. And boy, that's mercenary troops, more mercenaries than American soldiers. And they cost us more money, as far as one can see. So you just sort of sit there and you just wonder. I will put down money that we will find out that the Blackstone guys and a lot of these private contractors made large contributions to the political parties, and probably more to the Republicans. And this is U.S. having a mercenary army out there, which fits with the Rousseau stuff. That's bad. Okay, so I think there is a challenge in the politics to this. And I imagine you know it occurs you have young Abe Lincoln there, and he's saying, "Dad or Mom, can I run for president?" And what advice would you give young Abe Lincoln? I would say, go to Wall Street, get yourself a partnership in Goldman Sachs, make a few billion, and then, yes, son, anyone can run for president as long as they have that kind of money. And then I would say, of course, you could, if you wanted to, go around and spend all your time as a politician, you know, getting money from wealthy folks. And that really drives some politicians mad that they spend all their time doing that. So it has to be corroding our democracy. Okay, so now I'm going to give you some solutions. I called it first the Jefferson way. Jefferson was a big states' rights guy. And he was against national government. Hamilton was for national government. I've been working on some things with some colleagues for something we call progressive federalism, which is very much states' rights. And that... we'll see, and then I will talk about the other things, the shared capitalism. So these are my solutions, if I can phrase it right, to this challenge. Oh, and then I pointed out, I didn't bring that hat with me, but he was a member of the secret club called Flat Hat. I do have a flat hat, but I just didn't carry it with me on the here. There. Okay, what do I mean by states' rights? You don't normally think of as a solution to inequality problems or things like that, globalization. So I give you the what I think are the positive things about this. Most social services are state. There's a lot of diversity, and I think it is great that California has chosen some energy policies that the state of Arkansas does not choose. We don't want to be locked in. Everybody's got to do exactly the same thing. The states have done well to deliver services. Experimentation. And then the fifth one is something I don't know of any real evidence for, but it's an interesting proposition, because you notice that Republican governors and legislatures in states often make what seem to be more rational decisions, thoughtful decisions, than the administration in Washington. And you sort of sit there and say, well, why is that? Well, I think ideology gets lost a little bit. When you're dealing with real problems at a state level, whereas in Washington you can have ideology running wild. But I have no real evidence for that. This is just a listing of states that have enacted progressive laws as of March 2007. So states' rights as a vehicle for preserving democratic things. Minimum wage laws, we know, they've been widely studied. Indeed, that's been the heart of our great increase in knowledge that minimum wage laws don't have much effect on employment. And that's because states have this right. I put states supplements to federal EITC. Renewable energy. You go down the list of legislation of things, and the governor of California has been very good at this, of course, pushing with world leaders for energy and energy things. And in my state, before Mr. Romney, you know, has a medical... or with the Democratic legislature, passed the medical plan, which he now, I thinks is socialistic and evil, and he was never really in the state. And it wasn't him who signed the bill and so on. But these are set. We have a much bigger set of this. And it's just lists the states that have done things. Now, the interesting is what the national response to this is. And the limiting the health care program, okay, they don't want to pass any more spending on it, but they're also using as many administrative rules as they can to limit health care. So we do know that in one sense, the states are actually a bulwark for democracy against what has been a federal government that has not been good. And then these are just remarkable, I think. The key doctrine that the federal government uses to limit state democracy, and therefore I think to limit all of our democracy, is federal preemption. Federal preemption means that you can't do anything once the federal government has stepped into an area. And what we've seen in the last several years. It's come to an end, 2000, with the change of election, the Democrats winning. But you see Republicans who supposedly are devoted to, conservatives who are supposedly devoted to states' rights, doing everything they can to remove the rights of states to make decisions that run counter to their particular views, which Democrats have done this too, but right now it's Republicans. So I give you energy policy. They want to make sure that any private utility that has a federal permit can seize any land they want, and no state can stop them. The class action fairness, and there's the statement from the National Conference of State Legislatures, undermines our system of federalism, disrespects our state courts, etc. Then the one that was the scariest to me is the law enforcement safety. I didn't know this was passed. Has anyone here got a gun? Carrying a concealed weapon? You do have a right to carry a concealed weapon, and the state of California cannot stop anyone if they are a current off-duty and retired law enforcement agent. This was a special federal law designed to stop states from not allowing people to carry concealed weapons. And then we have a statement for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Did the police want this? Of course not. They don't want random people, even ex-police officers, carrying guns. The reason this cuts to me was in a class at Harvard many years ago, we did have a policeman from Texas who came to the class with his gun. And so we said to him, sir, we don't allow, I don't know, Harvard has a rule, but I assume we have a rule, we don't allow people to bring guns to our classes. And he said, but what happens if there's some bad guys here? I got to do something. And explained to him that, you know, maybe we could tackle the bad guy or something. And he put his gun away. But I realize now if someone came to the thing and this was a police officer. He was, you couldn't stop him. You couldn't legally say, no, that's not allowed. It's remarkable. So this is removal of states' rights as a thing. So I think one of the things, and I hope the next presidency, whichever Democrat or Republican, has greater respect for states' rights where we still have some democratic, we have some democratic procedures. Second thing that I offered a solution to this was I called shared capitalism. And this is very simple. If capital is going to be in the driver's seat for this 40 or 50 year transition, we want to make sure we're capitalists. Let's make sure we have some money. Turns out, we've paid for some questions on this general social survey every couple of years. Almost half of private sector workers actually are paid in some way that you consider to be capital related. They're covered by profit sharing, gain sharing, they own university stock, and they hold company stock options. I took this fact to the Harvard and I said, I want to be paid a share of the Harvard Fund, the Harvard Endowment, which does extremely well, as you may know. The university refused to change my pay to this way. And I explained to them how it actually increased the devotion to the employer and how we'd work harder and so on. So we have moved into this. And somewhere in the order of 35%, 40% of the stock market are owned by pension funds of workers. And so this is going on. And that means we will benefit, even though we may not benefit in our wages, if profits go up, we benefit as profit things. I think it's positive. The internet, I don't know too much about, but I gather that if we can have a good YouTube movie showing you combing your hair for half an hour, you're going to lose a lot of support from people who wonder about you. So, and that does offer, I think, average citizens a way of combating money, because you couldn't get as many people tapping into YouTube with whatever advertisements you do. I hope that's the case. The last thing is the globalization. How do we deal with footloose capital and things like that? Turns out there's a lot of local bias in the economy. People do spend in their local area. The firms prefer to have products, intermediate goods elsewhere. There's a lot. INS means investment savings are highly correlated across countries. There's no evidence that has weakened over time, even with globalization. People are, I could offer some of the people here, would you like to come to teach in, I don't know, Little Rock University? How much more would I have to pay you to leave Berkeley? Or if you're a grad student, how much would I have to pay you to go to, I don't know, some small university and get your degree in Mississippi or, you know, or Idaho, or what the heck? I don't want to be discriminatory against the South. And yeah, people are willing to take differentials. They're willing to pay more rent to live in certain places. So it is clear there are local things that matter a lot. And then I just have these two questions. I'm not sure what the answer is, because we would like to keep the country ahead during this transition as the technology and education is growing up elsewhere. We don't want to take big losses to our people, so we'd like to be able to say we can do some good things here, and that'll keep some good industries and good jobs here. And I just don't know, you know, how we don't have good evidence on how much we can do with that. And then I said, well, there are these dangers. I won't ask you to identify the two people, except neither of them is President Bush, nor Dick Cheney dressed up for Halloween. We can have all these disasters in this period. And then I do have a statement for you here. This does come from the administration that I'm obviously very dubious about. And they're still looking for the WMDs. And then, gee, I wonder what Rummy found. Oh my God. So we now know where the WMDs are and who the enemy of the country really is. But I think, let me phrase it this way, because I have no great, I mean, I the administration is what it is. And it is, though, through education and research and things like that, that we're going to cure our problems, not through other strange things. So I am a very positive person at the end. I say, well, I think we can overcome this challenge to our democracy. Part of it is that the millionaires and billionaires are not evil people. There's a lot more cooperation than we would anticipate from economic models. We now have brain scans that show this, it's hardwired fairness into us. So as people, I don't think we're out there to be totally bad. And I loved it when Warren Buffett said he should pay higher taxes. And he thought all the corporations should pay higher taxes and all the rich people should pay higher taxes. And then one of my friends said, can't he wait till I make my $40 billion and then pay the taxes? And it is true that Mr. Buffett, for all his, you know, being a great millionaire, he didn't say these things while he was making his money. He waited till retirement. Because that also says maybe that's why people should respect elders, that they have a different perspective. Okay, and this was brought to you by the hat company. And then for Halloween, I had some assistance. And this is a great movie if you've never seen it, Vincent Price. So that's the Halloween stuff. Okay, I'm done.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.